Okay, so we'll continue with some suttas that give some reflections on the nature of the hindrances and dealing with hindrances, and also to a disclaimer. There's no logical sequence for these. As I find them, or where I've looking up in an index, or memory has been jogged, and so that there's no overarching thematic presentation happening here. But it's all around the hindrances. So this sutta comes from the Sanyutta Nikaya. It's Sanyutta 3. It's in the Kosala Sanyutta, Sutta number 24. Atsavati. Sitting to one side, King Pasenadi of Kosala said to the Blessed One, "Venerable Sir, where should a gift be given?" And the Buddha's reply, "Wherever one's mind has confidence, great king." "But, venerable sir, where does what is given become of great fruit?" "This is one question, great king, where should a gift be given? And this another, where does what is given become of great fruit?" "What is given to one who is virtuous, great king, is of great fruit. Not so what is given to an immoral person. Now then, great king, I will question you about this same point. Answer as you see fit. What do you think, great king? Suppose you are at war and a battle is about to take place. Then a Kshatriya youth, from the noble classes or warrior classes, then a Kshatriya youth would arrive, one who is untrained, unskillful, unpracticed, inexperienced, timid, petrified, frightened, quick to flee. Would you employ that man? And would you have any use for such a man? Surely not, venerable sir. Then a Brahman youth would arrive, a Vaisa youth, a Sudha youth, who is untrained, quick to flee." So that's from the different four castes of the in the Buddha's time. "Who is untrained, unskillful, unpracticed, inexperienced, timid, petrified, frightened, quick to flee. Would you employ that man, and would you have any use for such a man? Surely not, venerable sir. What do you think, great king? Suppose you are at war, and a battle is about to take place. Then a Kshatriya youth would arrive, one who is trained, skillful, practiced, experienced, brave, courageous, bold, ready to stand his place. Would you employ that man, and would you have any use for such a man? Surely I would, venerable sir. Then a Brahman youth would arrive, a Vaisa youth, or a Sudha youth, one who is trained, skillful, practiced, experienced, brave, courageous, bold, ready to stand his place. Would you employ that man, and would you have any use for such a man? Surely I would, venerable sir. So too, great king, when a person has gone forth from the household life into homelessness, no matter from what clan, if he has abandoned five factors and possesses five factors, then what is given to him is of great fruit. What five factors have been abandoned? Sensual desire has been abandoned. Ill will has been abandoned. Sloth and torpor have been abandoned. Restlessness and remorse have been abandoned. Doubt has been abandoned. What five factors does he possess? He possesses the aggregate of virtue of one beyond training, the aggregate of concentration of one beyond training, the aggregate of wisdom of one beyond training, the aggregate of liberation of one beyond training, the aggregate of the knowledge and vision of liberation of one beyond training. He possesses these five factors. Thus, what is given to one who has abandoned five factors and who possesses five factors is of great fruit. And then this is in verse. As a king intent on waging war would employ a youth skilled with the bow, one endowed with strength and vigor, but not the coward on account of his birth. So even though he be of low birth, one should honor the person of noble conduct, the sagely being in whom are established the virtues of patience and gentleness. One should build delightful hermitages and invite the learned to dwell in them. One should build water tanks in the forest and causeways over rough terrain. With a confident heart, one should give to those of upright character, give food and drink and things to eat, clothing to wear and beds and seats. For as the rain cloud, thundering, wreathed in lightning, with 100 crests, pours down its rain upon the earth, flooding both the plain and the valley, so the wise being, faithful, learned, having had a meal prepared, satisfies with food and drink the mendicants who live on alms. Rejoicing, he distributes gifts and proclaims, "Give, give." For that is his thundering, like the sky when it rains. That shower of merit so vast will pour down on the giver. So that I think the first interesting thing about this sutta is the question of and the answer when should a gift be given. There are other places in the suttas where the Buddha is criticized for saying that gifts should only be given to, and say, dana should only be offered to his disciples, not to anybody else's. And King Pasenadi, in asking this question, is sort of setting clarifying a criticism that was going around in the Buddha's time. And so that he asked quite directly, where should a gift be given? And then the Buddha's response is, to give where your mind has confidence, where you have faith. And and then the follow-up question of where does what is given become of great fruit? And then the Buddha says, well, those are two different questions. One is giving where one has faith, and the other is where is what is given is actually becomes of great fruit, great benefit. And so then the Buddha is pointing to the degree of virtue and wholesome qualities that person possesses. And of course, again, the Buddha making the point that it's not around the caste system, which was actually, very much the case, I think, that Brahmins didn't have much to do with other castes in terms of service and assistance, and and even to this day, the caste system is still kind of fairly well in place in India. But then the Buddha is sort of saying, what is the the basis of what one's going to make a decision on in terms of what bears good fruit? It's around the training in skillfulness and goodness, and in the same way that one doesn't want whether one's from a well-born caste, a well-born family, whatever, all of that, they if they're untrained, unskillful, petrified, frightened, quick to flee, they're not going to be much use on a battlefield. And that sense of being what is going to be of benefit in whatever in terms of the is around the training. And of course, in any person who is gone forth this abandoning of the five hindrances and then the possessing of the factors of the fruits of the training. So that's an interesting sutta. Any questions on that sutta?
It's a small question.
Yeah.
All the notes you just start off, what do you think? What do you think? Is there a recurring sort of question in the sutta?
Right, right.
I'm just wondering, it just seems, I can't really hear someone saying that in a conversation, so I'm wondering what sort of other possible translations there are.
Let's see. I would have to know the Pali to be able to see what the idiom is. It's more like, and so that maybe what's your position or what's your perspective on this? Because it's a question. What's your perspective on this? Suppose you're at war, as opposed, what do you think is? It hadn't really thrown up any flags for me. So that I think it's a, maybe it's an idiom that's not so much in use these days, but then maybe the idiom is more pointing to, what's your perspective on this, or how do you consider this?
He likes to engage the people he's talking with through questioning.
It's engaging in the discussion, or getting them to participate in discussion, and draw them into reflecting. So that's the tool, I think, of what it's pointing to.
It's not just a one-way monologue. You're involved in this.
Yeah.
And usually it sounds like it refers to the next bit of information.
Yeah.
What do you think about this?
Yeah. I think so. Yeah. Okay, so this next sutta is actually from the Satipatthana Samyutta, Samyutta 47, sutta number 5, and it's the kind of illustrating the interdependence or interrelationship between the unskillful and the skillful. Kusala and akusala. At Savati, there the Blessed One said this, "Bhikkhus, if one were to say of anything, quote, a heap of the unwholesome, unquote, it is about the five hindrances that one could rightly say this. For this is a complete heap of the unwholesome, that is, the five hindrances. What five? The hindrance of sensual desire, the hindrance of ill will, the hindrance of sloth and torpor, the hindrance of restlessness and remorse, the hindrance of doubt. If one were to say of anything, a heap of the unwholesome, it is about these five hindrances that one could rightly say this, for this is a complete heap of the unwholesome, that is, the five hindrances. If, because one were to say of anything, a heap of the wholesome, it is about the four establishments of mindfulness that one could rightly say this, for this is a complete heap of the wholesome, that is, the four establishments of mindfulness. What four? Here, bhikkhus, a bhikkhu dwells contemplating the body in the body, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. He dwells contemplating feelings in feelings, mind in mind, phenomena in phenomena, ardent, clearly comprehending, mindful, having removed covetousness and displeasure in regard to the world. If one were to say of anything a heap of the wholesome, it is about these four establishments of mindfulness that one could rightly say this, for this is a complete heap of the wholesome, that is, the four establishments of mindfulness. Quite straightforward statement of how the Buddha's perception. So this next sutta, also from the Satipatthana Samyutta, Samyutta 47, sutta number 12, and this is the sort of kind of returning to the interplay between the five hindrances and the seven factors of enlightenment. Sutta illustrating this. On one occasion, the Blessed One was dwelling at Nalanda in Pavaraka's mango grove. Then the Venerable Sariputta approached the Blessed One, paid homage to him, sat down to one side, and said to him, "Venerable Sir, I have such confidence in the Blessed One that I believe there has not been, nor ever will be, nor exists at present, another ascetic or Brahman more knowledgeable than the Blessed One with respect to enlightenment." "Lofty indeed is this bellowing utterance of yours, Sariputta. You have roared a definitive categorical lion's roar." "Venerable Sir, I have such confidence in the Blessed One that I believe there has not been, nor ever will be, nor exists at present, another ascetic or Brahman more knowledgeable than the Blessed One with respect to enlightenment. Have you now, Sariputta, encompassed with your mind the minds of all the Arahants, the perfectly enlightened ones, arisen in the past and known thus? These Blessed Ones were of such virtue, such qualities, or of such wisdom, or of such dwellings, or of such liberation." "No, Venerable Sir." "Then, Sariputta, have you encompassed your mind with the minds, have you encompassed with your mind the minds of all the Arahants, the perfectly enlightened ones, who will arise in the future and known thus? Those Blessed Ones will be of such virtue, of such qualities, or of such wisdom, or of such dwellings, or of such liberation." "No, Venerable Sir." "Then, Sariputta, have you encompassed with your mind my own mind, I being at present the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one, and known thus? The Blessed One is of such virtue, or of such qualities, or of such wisdom, or of such dwellings, or of such liberation." "No, Venerable Sir." "Sariputta, when you do not have any knowledge encompassing the minds of the Arahants, the perfectly enlightened ones, of the past, the future, and the present, why do you utter this lofty bellowing utterance and roar this definitive categorical lion's roar? Venerable Sir, I have such confidence in the Blessed One that I believe there has not been nor ever will be nor exists at present another ascetic or Brahman more knowledgeable than the Blessed One with respect to enlightenment." "I do not have, Venerable Sir, any knowledge encompassing the minds of the Arahants, the perfectly enlightened ones of the past, the future, and the present. But still I have understood this by inference from the Dhamma. Suppose, Venerable Sir, a king had a frontier city with strong ramparts, walls and arches, and with a single gate. The gatekeeper posted there would be wise, competent, and intelligent, one who keeps out strangers and admits acquaintances. While he is walking along the path that encircles the city, he would not see a cleft or an opening in the walls even big enough for a cat to slip through. He might think, whatever large creatures enter or leave this city, all enter and leave through this one gate. So too, Venerable Sir, I have understood this by inference from the Dhamma. Whatever Arahants, perfectly enlightened ones, arose in the past, all those Blessed Ones had first abandoned the five hindrances, corruptions of the mind, and weakeners of wisdom. And then, with their minds well established in the four establishments of mindfulness, they had developed correctly the seven factors of enlightenment, and thereby they had awakened to this unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. And, Venerable Sir, whatever arahants, perfectly enlightened ones, will arise in the future, all those blessed ones will first abandon the five hindrances, corruptions of the mind and weakeners of wisdom, and then with their minds well established in the four establishments of mindfulness, they will develop correctly the seven factors of enlightenment, and thereby they will awaken to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. And, Venerable Sir, the Blessed One, who is at present, the Arahant, the perfectly enlightened one, first abandon the five hindrances, corruptions of the mind and weakeners of wisdom, and then, with his mind well established in the four establishments of mindfulness, he developed correctly the seven factors of enlightenment, and thereby he has awakened to the unsurpassed perfect enlightenment. Good, good, Sariputta. Therefore, Sariputta, you should repeat this Dhamma exposition frequently to the bhikkhus and the bhikkhunis, to the male lay followers and the female lay followers, even though some foolish people may have perplexity or uncertainty regarding the Tathagata. When they hear this Dhamma exposition, their perplexity or uncertainty regarding the Tathagata will be abandoned. It's a very beautiful, to me, a very beautiful sutta, and one that, brings it back to principles. And Sariputta is, of course, foremost in wisdom, but he's not known for any special powers. And this one, yeah, sees very clearly the basis of wisdom and discernment, and relying on and through inference of the Dhamma, so in some ways, taking it away from the personal is incredibly important, because if one's, say, faith and confidence in one's holy life or in one's spiritual aspiration is based on some individual somewhere, some teacher or some assumption of attainment by even the Buddha, then how do you and the Buddha is incredibly rigorous in his logic, and immediately turns it around on Sariputta, even though Sariputta is giving this incredible praise. And then the Buddha said, "Well, do you actually have knowledge of this?" No, but through inference of the Dhamma, through the Dhamma, that one makes assumption through these Dhamma principles. And I think I don't know about anybody else, but if I have to wait for my sort of knowledge of to be based on some personal affirmation from another teacher or leader or spiritual guide, then it might be a long, long process, but these Dhamma principles are always to hand, and one can be investigating them consistently and in the present. And I think it's important to not give away one's authority in practice to some individual who you can't actually make any clear confirmation of attainment, and all one has to rely on is one's one's own recognition of one's own adherence to these principles of Dhamma, so that relying on that relinquishing and abandoning of the five hindrances, the cultivation of the four foundations of mindfulness and the seven factors of enlightenment, and that is enough. That's way more than enough. I'll do one more. This is from the Majjhima Nikaya, from the Gopaka Moggallana Sutta, Sutta 108. And it's I'm not going to read the whole sutta, it's just a section of the sutta on aspects of the, say, in meditation, meditation that the Buddha approved of and meditation that the Buddha didn't approve of. This was given at... there's actually a sutta given by Ananda after the Buddha passed away, and given in the bamboo grove near Rajagaha. And it's to the Brahmin Gopaka Moggallana, and he's asking various questions. There's probably a group of Brahmins around, and they've had different conversations. Then the Brahmin Vasakara, the minister of Magadha, said to the Venerable Ananda, "Where is Master Ananda living now?" "Now I'm living in the bamboo grove, Brahman." "I hope, Master Ananda, that the bamboo grove is pleasant, quiet, and undisturbed by voices, with an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people, favorable for a retreat." "Indeed, Brahman, that the bamboo grove is pleasant, quiet, and undisturbed by voices, with an atmosphere of seclusion, remote from people, favorable for retreat, is because of such guardian protectors as yourself." "Indeed, Master Ananda, that the bamboo grove is pleasant," and so on and so far, "favorable for retreat, is because of the worthy ones who are meditators and cultivate meditation." "The worthy ones are meditators and cultivate meditation. On one occasion, Master Ananda, Master Gotama was living at Vesali in the hall with a peaked roof in the great wood. Then I went there and approached Master Gotama, and in many ways he gave a talk about meditation. Master Gotama was a meditator and cultivated meditation, and he praised every type of meditation. The Blessed One, Brahman, did not praise every type of meditation, nor did he condemn every type of meditation. What kind of meditation did the Blessed One not praise? Here, Brahman, someone abides with his mind obsessed by sensual lust, a prey to sensual lust, and he does not understand, as it actually is, the escape from the arisen sensual lust. While he harbors sensual lust within, he meditates, premeditates, outmeditates, and mismeditates. He abides with his mind obsessed by ill will, a prey to ill will. He abides with his mind obsessed by sloth and torpor, a prey to sloth and torpor. He abides with his mind obsessed by restlessness and remorse, a prey to restlessness and remorse. He abides with his mind obsessed by doubt, a prey to doubt, and he does not understand, as it actually is, the escape from arisen doubt. While he harbors doubt within, he meditates, premeditates, outmeditates, and mismeditates. The Blessed One did not praise that kind of meditation. And what kind of meditation did the Blessed One praise? Here, Brahman, quite secluded from sensual pleasures, secluded from unwholesome states, a bhikkhu enters upon and abides in the first jhana, and so on and so forth, the stilling of applied and sustained thought. A description, standard description of the four jhanas. And he enters upon and abides in the fourth jhana. The Blessed One prays that kind of meditation. It seems, Master Ananda, that Master Gotama censured that kind of meditation that should be censured and praised that kind of meditation that should be praised. And now, Master Ananda, we depart. We are busy and have much to do. You may go, Brahman, at your own convenience. Then the Brahman Vasakara, the minister of Magadha, having delighted and rejoiced in the Venerable Ananda's words, rose from the seat and departed. Ananda clarifying that one can meditate obsessed with any of the five hindrances. Ajahn Jeff translates it a bit different. There's a case where a certain person dwells with his awareness overcome by sensual passion. Seized by with sensual passion, he does not discern the escape as it actually is present from sensual passion once it has arisen. Making that sensual passion the focal point, he absorbs himself with it. He besorbs, resorbs, and supersorbs himself with it. The words are jayanti. So the same root as jhana, sort of. Jayanti, and then it goes jayanti, bhajayanti, nijayanti, apajayanti. Individually they're not a pejorative. But when it's used like this, then it's seen as a kind of a denigration, and playing on these words. But it's a good, sort of the Buddha's sort of wry humor sometimes.